when bad moms happen to good people.
The power to adopt 5 children, to raise them, to educate them. I will never be ungrateful for that.
Along with Madea, perhaps, actress Joan Crawford is the Halloween bad mother queen. But you don't need a Greek tragedy to be cast as a bad mom in this day and age.
Bad mother, bad mother, bad mother, bad mother, bad mother. Bad
mothers get shafted. One bad mom tries to set us straight. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Can you dig it? Good morning. It's Thursday, May 7th. I'm John Huckenberry, joined this morning by Farai Chidea. Good morning.
Hey, John. So coming up this hour, the banking system's a little busted, yes, but what's the alternative?
We got to have a banking system. I completely get that. We're not going to go back to bartering pigs for haircuts. You know, that's not going to work here.
All right. We're hearing from Elizabeth Warren, the chair of the congressional panel overseeing TARP funds. That interview and more coming up. But first, these headlines.
In the headlines, General Motors lost $6 billion last quarter and spent $10 billion more than it took in. GM is the nation's biggest automaker, and it's gotten $15 billion in federal loans to deal with its tumbling profits. GM faces a June 1st government deadline to come up with a viable business model. This latest set of numbers probably isn't going to help that. The earnings report comes as GM hosts 500 of its biggest buyers at a spa and golf course in Arizona. Report card day for the nation's 19 largest banks. Regulators will formally publish the results of the stress tests today. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner told PBS's Charlie Rose last night that the government shouldn't act too quickly to stop aiding the financial system.
Classic mistake of financial crises is governments, they step on the brake too quickly and they arrest the tenuous sign of recovery, pushing the economy to a more vulnerable point again, prolonging the recession.
Some of the findings of the stress tests have already been leaked, the Treasury telling Citibank and Bank of America to raise capital and do it fast. Farai?
In Washington, President Obama is expected to ask Congress today to cut $17 billion from the proposed 2010 budget. Pentagon spending takes about half of that hit. But those cuts pale next to another $1.3 trillion in the budget the president has already asked Congress to pass. And in Pakistan, the Red Cross warns the humanitarian crisis is getting worse. Tens of thousands of refugees are fleeing the Swat Valley. The Red Cross says its teams are unable to reach the areas most affected by fighting. UN workers at a refugee camp say children are exhausted and distressed by the bombing. Clashes began there last week after the Pakistani army accused the Taliban of breaking a peace agreement. And today in Afghanistan, police fired into a crowd of protesters throwing rocks. Those protesters blame the U.S. bombing runs in western Afghanistan for dozens of civilian deaths, but a U.S. military official says the Taliban is to blame for many of the deaths in that raid.
The weekly jobless claim numbers is coming up later in the morning, and the Dow and the S&P were both up more than 1% yesterday. The S&P starts trading at 9:20. So for Mother's Day on Sunday and later on in the program, we're going to talk to a woman who found it hard to balance her parenting responsibilities with her professional ones. She wrote the book on Bad Mother. That's the name of the book. We want to know, have you ever been tagged a bad mom? What do you do that makes you worry that people are going to call you a bad mom? Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. The bar is low for bad moms, turns out.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. Responsibilityproject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Huckenberry. Report cards all over Washington today. The stress test results for the biggest banks are going to be released. Apparently, Bank of America and Citigroup not going to do very well. And the monthly report on the TARP, the Toxic Asset Relief Program, that also gets released today. And what's all the report cards about? Well, the buzzword, the central principle. Let's get something straight from the Obama administration on the bank bailout.
Transparency.
And transparency and accountability.
Transparency and oversight.
Unprecedented transparency.
Transparency.
Standards of transparency.
Transparency.
Clarity and transparency.
That's right. Whether we agree with the trillions of dollars being spent on the financial bailout or not, we're all supposed to be able to watch the tax money and printed greenbacks drain out of the Treasury and the Fed and land like a Niagara Falls on the financial sector. Well, unlike the Falls, the TARP program is not a tourist attraction with a neat viewing stand for visitors. Elizabeth Warren joins us now. She's the chairwoman of the Congressional Oversight Panel, which is the panel that by law watches the TARP fund. And Elizabeth Warren, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So in your oversight role, I mean, this is a huge thing to be monitoring, it seems to me. If we were to think of the Treasury as a profligate spender, okay, who needs maybe some roping in, as you look at the TARP program and the other sort of ancillary programs in Treasury, how well is that huge consumer doing in controlling his or her spending?
Better than before. And that's always a good way to start it. Remember, $350 billion went out the door in commitments in the first few weeks while Henry Paulson was still Secretary of the Treasury. And it went out on terms that said, take our money, please. No restrictions, no limitations on how to spend it. Just we're going to give it to the financial institutions and trust you to do what you think is the right thing with it. Basically, our panel kind of did the metaphoric, you know, jumped up and down and pulled our hair out and screamed and threw things and kept talking about transparency, accountability, clarity in the government program. And by golly, we get what I think of as Treasury 2. You know, Secretary Geithner comes in, and let's face it, he starts in a deep hole as a consequence of this, both financially and kind of in terms of confidence. And look, they're more transparent than they were before. The programs are, you know, online. They've explained more of them. There's somewhat more accountability, more restrictions on how the money's going to be spent. He divided it up among different programs. He's still holding $110 billion in reserve. And there's a little more clarity, a little more, around what the pieces are. So if what we're doing
so you're
is
feeling
measuring,
better.
I'm feeling better.
Right.
And that's the answer. It's definitely better.
So let's talk a little bit about where the money is going. I mean, certainly there was a lot of concern about the money being spent on bonuses for executives at some of these institutions. How much of your oversight is other than that? Let's put the bonuses aside for a minute. What other oversight issues are you really measuring?
So let me put it this way. Our real job, think about the overall design. Congress said, here's $700 billion to Treasury because – you know, Secretary Paulson had said, give us $700 billion or the economy dies. You know, so Congress says, here's the money. But they recognize this is an emergency. You don't stand behind the firefighter and say, and so much water should be directed here and so much here and so much here. So they designed this oversight panel to stand on the outside. And we actually have very little description of what we're supposed to do other than how we're supposed to think about the central ideas behind what Treasury's supposed to be doing.
So, but that's a little sad in the sense it's like your mission is to, all right, stand here, Elizabeth, and watch this car wreck that's going to happen in a few minutes.
And keep screaming warnings.
Yeah.
So that, you know, in a sense, that is our job. So what I do is I keep standing out there saying, hey, guys, you got to be clearer about this. We got to see what's going on. We got to believe these numbers. You've got to show us things that are true and accurate. So I keep pounding on the table for that. You got to make these folks accountable. On a regular basis, you can't just give money away and hope that it goes in the directions we thought. And you really got to explain more about the programs. You've got to explain and put in some metrics in place so that we can see if you're making it from point A to point B to point Z. So we stand out there, and frankly, the job is we keep pushing. And if we push them a foot, then I just move forward a foot and try to push them a foot further. That's what I see as my job.
Are you really a we, though? And I ask that in the sense that there has been some pushback from the Republican members of the panel. And there is a bit of a fracture about how you go about your business. What do you think the fundamental difference is of opinion? And have you been able to work it out over time?
You know, this has been really interesting for me. I'm a total Washington outsider. The last elective office I held, I think, was sometime back in seventh grade. And I'm, you know, so I'm not part of that world. But I'll say this. When we've gone through our work for each of these monthly reports, we reach out to experts all around the country, indeed, sometimes all around the globe. We talk to people who, politically speaking, are on the left and on the right. We talk to people and try to gather data from every source and analyze it every way we can. So just to pick an example, our regulatory reform report, we had a lot of consensus from a lot of different points of view. Our work doesn't fracture along ordinary left-right lines. I mean, come on, talking about accountability and transparency, these are not left-right issues. On the other hand, yeah, we got folks on our panel who have belonged to different political parties, and they think that's a significant part of the mix. I just don't see it that way.
Well, let me test the transparency issue right here.
I mean, sure.
Can you call up Timothy Geithner today, get him on the phone, and ask him point blank, how much of the money have you given out, Secretary Geithner, has come from the TARP, and how much exactly in dollar amounts has come from the Fed reserves, which are two different spigots, and you're supposed to be watching both of them?
Yep. Yes.
And his answer would be,
well,
and has been?
His answer has been to lay the dollars out, and I will
say.
So
how much is it? Which
well,
is which?
This is it. We do have some disputes back and forth. We push back. You know, let's face it, even accounting has some creativity to it. And so there have been some disputes. But basically, what we have so far is about $590 billion has come out of TARP, which is the, you know, the amount that Congress put
congressionally
there.
Authorized fund.
Fed, remember.
That's the magic money.
Fed is the magic money.
That's the printing money.
And we think we're in the neighborhood of about $4.2
trillion. Whoa. Wait a minute. A headline.
No, I don't mean to do new headlines. I'm trying to do – actually, these are numbers that I think, unless I got them wrong. These are numbers that came from Borofsky. And that you're now scaring me when you
well,
give me this
Well, I think
space.
That's not widely known, and I think possibly it's because of the media coverage, and possibly it's because of the way this information comes out, but that's really important.
Right. Well, and let me say it this way. This is one of the things that people have worried a lot about. On the Fed end of it, that's taking the biggest version of the number. On the Fed end of it, it's a lot of guarantees. It's not just money that's been spent, money that's been infused into programs. A lot of the Fed is total commitment money. Now, what the Fed defenders would say is, hey, you know, if the bad things don't happen, then you never have to pay off on the guarantee. So the amount of money that actually leaves the Fed is different from the amount of money that we may have done a backstop. We may have committed if it is there. So that may be part of the reason we get very different numbers on how much Fed money is in here, because it depends on whether you want to add up all guarantees or you want to talk about real dollars that have already gone out the door. TARP is a lot easier to watch in that sense because we're watching real dollars go out the door.
Well, just quickly, a lot of folks have criticized the way that the federal government has put incredible scrutiny on the car companies and has, in some ways, forced the car companies to be accountable for every cent. And TARP, as we're talking about, there is a large fuzziness about what the government is demanding for these trillions of dollars in TARP and the other programs. Why do you think it is that there's this disjunction between the ways the federal government operates in terms of oversight? And is it either unfair to the car companies or too lenient to the banks or both?
You know, I want to say that you just asked me the question that I asked Timothy Geithner when the Congressional Oversight Panel ran a hearing with Secretary Geithner. I think it's been about 2 weeks ago. That was my opening question. I want to understand the difference between the two. You know,
hemmed and hawed.
We'd have to do a replay.
I
don't think I could. I'll put it this way. I don't think I could fairly characterize his answer.
And it probably would take longer than 32 seconds to even replay his answer. Well, Elizabeth Warren, a lot to talk about there. Those numbers are really staggering. It seems like the printing presses have rolled at the very least at the Fed. But the big question is, what does a credit crisis mean for consumers? And let's talk about that a little bit later.
All right.
Elizabeth Warren, of course, is the chairwoman of the Congressional Oversight Panel looking at the TARP. She's also the Gottlieb Professor of Law at Harvard University. And I want to remind you, you can go to thetakeaway.org and see our web-only video. It's us talking with Elizabeth Warren. And also on our website, you can read an excerpt from her book, All You're Worth. We'll talk to Elizabeth Warren more about consumers and credit crunches in just a moment.
can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry, who wrote the book on bad motherhood. Ilette Waldman is going to be here later on in the program. We're asking you, have you ever been tagged as a bad mom? Johnny Sue writes to us, I've always been a working mom. When my daughter was young, some of the stay-at-home moms would look at me with something like disdain when I came to PTO meetings and helped out at school functions, like I was invading their territory. That's changing now, along with the economy. Suddenly, many places are a lot more accommodating to working parents. Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Speaking of a working mom, you have Elizabeth Warren. She has actually written a book in the past with her own daughter. And, of course, she is a grown woman who is now a Take Charge chairwoman of the Congressional Oversight Panel charged with following the billions of dollars the government's giving to financial institutions through the TARP program. The Oversight Panel issues a report today that looks at TARP. She has tackled everything, including credit cards. Now, Elizabeth, let's listen to a real-life example from The Takeaway. Last month, Philomena called from upstate New York to tell us her credit card story.
I was talking to Bank of America yesterday because of a letter we received. We have over a 700 credit score, never paid a bill partially, always in full, and they decided to halve our credit availability.
Is that something that the company should be held accountable for, restricting credit at a time when there is so much government funding going to try to loosen credit? And we're talking here about people who have good or decent scores.
Right. So, you know, this is the big policy question that's on the table right now. Should a condition of receiving taxpayer support be that you use a little more customer-friendly practices?
Because in theory, they're getting almost free money from the feds, and they can jack up these fees and interest rates on the other side. I mean, that's a huge business. I'd love to get into that business.
No kidding. And it really boosts your profits. And, you know, for the companies, that works out really well. It's a way to boost up your profits. And, hey, maybe you'll be able to pay back your government money eventually. You'll be able to weather this crisis. But it's also potentially very destabilizing to a lot of families who are budgeted close to the wire. You know, they're making their payments. They're doing what they're supposed to be doing. And you jerk up those interest rates, you cut back on the credit line, and they're in real trouble now.
You know, your book, The Two Income Trap, was something that you did with your daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And which I find, you know, as a woman in particular, I find that fascinating. What was it like to team up to do that kind of important work with your own child?
Well, you know, we were looking at all this data that I had. I had a new study out on families who'd filed for bankruptcy, and I'm trying to figure out what I want to do with these data. And my little baby granddaughter was born, and this is Amelia, my daughter's baby. And so we kept having these conversations around when she was born, and finally that became the frame to the book. Now, we don't really describe it that way in the book, but the truth is it's about what happened in one generation, what it meant to start a family in the early 1970s and kind of, you know, how it worked on income and housing and schools and costs and budgets and savings, and what it's been like to try to start a family in the 2000s, in the early 2000s. And the world has changed profoundly in that one generation snapshot. And that's what we ended up writing the book around.
So many people thought, okay, this is great. We've had second wave feminism, which has allowed women to go to work, and women are still having kids, and the guys are still working. What's wrong with that equation of everything being cool?
Yeah, well, the problem is I just keep looking at this from the economics. You know, I'm just a straightforward, I'm just a money girl. I want to see at the end of the day what's happening, and here's the bottom line on what's happening. The only way over one generation that families are making any increase in money is by putting a second person into the workforce. That is, the wages of a man, hate to tell you this, Adjusted for inflation, median earning male in the United States makes $800 less than he used to.
She was looking
one generation
at me.
Back.
She was looking at me. I just got a pay cut
just,
here.
That's yeah. right. I just wanted yeah, you to definitely. Know. Okay, yeah. $800
get
down.
Those kids out working.
So the only way we could continue to get some kind of rise in family income was by putting a second worker in. But the problem is core expenses outstrip that. Housing, health insurance, transportation, child care, and taxes, because families are paying right on these two salaries. At the end of the day, today's two-income family has less money left over after those five basic expenses than the one-income family had a generation ago.
So you got your headphones on?
I got them on.
Listen to this sound here. You know what that sound is?
Yeah, I know.
That's the sound of what?
That's the sound of those credit card processing things.
Not being declined.
Not being declined.
Kind of a cliffhanger for consumers, really, for a long, long time. But in this environment where we're told every day there's a credit crunch, what if these two-income families who you describe as more in debt now than ever before fall off the edge as a result of the changes that have taken place even in the last few months in this economy?
You know, this is the part that's really scary, because when Amelia and I wrote the book, it was still boom times. In fact, a lot of people that we talked with laughed at us. You know, oh, what do you mean about the deteriorating economic situation of the American family? Times are great, party on, party on. We are in such a weakened state going into this recession. People are not stopping to account for this, that we're hitting unemployment, we're hitting rises in costs at a time when the American family was already staggering economically. The federal government said on their mortgage mitigation program that if any bank was going to take TARP money, they had to be willing to participate in the mortgage program to try to help on foreclosures. The question on the table is, should they do the same thing on credit cards and other practices? There are a lot of folks, even within my own panel, who say no.
You say yes.
And I'm one of the people who says yes.
All right. Well, I'm going to have to leave it right there. Certainly have learned a lot from you, Elizabeth Warren. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks again to Elizabeth Warren, chairwoman of the Congressional Oversight Panel on TARP, and also professor of law at Harvard Law School. You can go to thetakeaway.org to see our web-only video with, Elizabeth talking to me and John, and also on
talking
our
talking about the mother-daughter relationship.
Talking about mother-daughter relationship.
And what she was elected to in seventh grade. You'll
yeah.
be surprised.
Oh, that's a great one from you, John. Yeah. Okay. And now we have Femi Okeh with the headlines.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. The time is 29 minutes past the hour. The government stress tests measuring the financial health of 19 of the country's largest banks are due out today. The tests gauge how much money the banks would need in a deeper recession. President Obama's pick to oversee the Food and Drug Administration is expected to face questions on Capitol Hill today about food safety. Margaret Hamburg is to appear before a Senate panel considering her nomination. The agency is still reeling from outbreaks of salmonella poisoning earlier this year and of tomatoes and peppers in 2008, although I should say tomatoes, but that's hard for me to say now.
We vaguely understand what you're talking about.
You know how it goes. In international news, we're looking at rioting breaking out in the Republic of Georgia yesterday. It was aimed at disrupting the NATO military exercises there.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good I'm Farai Chidea.
Oh, good morning, Farai. I'm John Hockenberry. And what is at stake in Pakistan? It's possibly the most important strategic relationship of the Barack Obama presidency. What's at stake there was stated very, very succinctly by the president speaking at the White House yesterday.
And we must do more than stand against those who would destroy Pakistan. We must stand with those who want to build Pakistan. And that is why I've asked Congress for sustained funding to build schools and roads and hospitals. I want the Pakistani people to understand that America is not simply against terrorism. We are on the side of their hopes and their aspirations.
Well, the hopes and aspirations of the Pakistani people in the city of Mingori, which is the largest city in the Swat Valley, might not be with the United States at this point. They might not even be with the Pakistani government at this point, because thousands of Pakistanis are fleeing in the Swat Valley, escaping from battles unfolding between the Pakistani military and the Taliban. It's a 50-mile arc northwest of the Pakistani capital, Islamabad, and it may represent, depending on how things develop over the next few days, the biggest refugee exodus Pakistan has seen since partition. Mark Dummett joins us. He's the BBC reporter in Islamabad. Mark, thanks for being with us.
No problem.
And we also go now to Geneva, Switzerland, where Ron Redman, the chief spokesperson for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, joins us. Ron, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Ron, what are you seeing in terms of the refugee situation, particularly, and what are the conditions for refugees? We have tens of thousands already fleeing in the battlefield areas in Bunir and Mingora and other areas of the Swat Valley.
I heard from one of our teams who are in Mardan, which is just on the fringes of the conflict area. They say that people are indeed streaming out in very large numbers, exact numbers as yet unknown. They're coming from inside Swat. A journey that had previously taken about 2 hours by road is now taking 4 hours just because of the sheer number of people and vehicles on the road fleeing the area. So it's a huge number of people coming out, and they're joining a very, very large number of people who were already displaced in that region last year, some 555,000. So if you've got another 500,000 coming, as some people are predicting, it's going to be very, very large.
If there are 500,000 coming, is there any sort of facility infrastructure available for them, and where are they likely to end up?
Well, a lot of people, when they flee and fled previously, stay with relatives, friends, family. In fact, we have about 93,000 people who are now staying in 11 camps that are supported by the UN Refugee Agency. Those are people who fled last year. But there are another 462,000 in the area who are living with host families and rental accommodation and so on. But the more people who flee, the more people who are displaced, the less chances that they're going to find some place to move into. So that's going to be a problem. And we're rushing aid supplies, tents, everything we can get into that region to be prepared.
And the refugees are rushing that much faster. Overcrowded camps and difficult infrastructure in the middle of a war zone, essentially in the Swat Valley. Ron Redman, chief spokesperson for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, thanks for joining us from Geneva, Switzerland. Mark Dummett, BBC reporter in Islamabad. It appears as though this refugee situation is yet another sign of the lack of credibility or questionable credibility of the Zardari government in Pakistan. Is it safe to say that the Swat Valley is lost to this government and possibly Northwest Frontier Province with it?
Well, actually, I think it's the opposite of that, really. The people are fleeing because the army has made it very clear that they aren't prepared to leave the Swat Valley to the Taliban. They're basically going to start an offensive to recapture this part of northern Pakistan in the coming days. And they've let the population know that, and they've told the people there to get out so that they're not killed in the battle. So actually this is an attempt by the Zardari government to reassert its authority over Pakistan and to deal some kind of blow to the Taliban. Now, the question then will be whether they're capable of doing it, because in the past they might have been able to beat the Taliban in a fight, but the Taliban have always come back stronger. So this isn't really, I wouldn't say, a sign of weakness, but a sign that they're trying to reassert their strength.
Well, it's also a sign that they're all in. If you ask 500,000 people to move because you're going to eliminate their enemy, you better do it, right?
Yeah, well, exactly. And, I mean, this has come after sort of 2 years in which the army has unsuccessfully been taking on the Taliban in Swat. And during those, where in particular, there were two campaigns really to beat the Taliban there. And on both occasions, a lot of civilians, hundreds of civilians were killed and houses destroyed. The Taliban were never defeated. So the people just said, look, enough's enough. We've got to negotiate with the Taliban. That's the only way we're going to have peace in this area and we can get our lives back to normal. So in February, the government agreed to this peace deal with the Taliban.
And let's just remind people that peace deal involved the imposition of Sharia law in the Swat Valley. I'm guessing that that deal is completely off the table no matter what happens on the battlefield. And as you say, it's coming to a head in Mingora, the largest city in Bunir.
Right, absolutely. I mean, I think that deal is pretty much over. And we heard this morning that the son of Sufi Muhammad, the Islamist cleric who brokered that deal, was killed in a bombardment. The deal was dead before that, to be honest, though, as well. When we heard that the Taliban were using their position of strength in Swat to take over neighbouring areas. And then there were these series of extraordinarily strong comments out of Washington from Hillary Clinton, General Petraeus, and President Obama as well, who all said that this was a sign of the weakness of the government. Clinton said that the Zardari had basically abdicated to the Taliban, that Pakistan could fall. Of course, this is a nuclear-powered country, a nuclear-armed country, so raising the prospect that the militants could take over the nukes as well. Well, of course, you know, most Pakistanis don't believe that. This is still very much in the mountains. It's not in the heartland of Pakistan yet. But certainly the pressure's been mounting on the government to do something about the Taliban. And sure enough, Zardari goes to Washington to meet Obama. And at the same time, his army is getting ready to go back into Swat.
Even higher stakes than we had imagined. The government now has to demonstrate that militarily it can defeat the Taliban because the diplomatic option is off the table. Mark Dummett, BBC reporter in Islamabad, thanks so much for all that detail. And Femi Okay now has some headlines for us.
21 minutes to the top of the hour. Just getting some figures in from the Labour Department. New applications for jobless benefits plunged to the lowest level in 14 weeks. It could be a sign that the massive wave of layoffs has peaked. But the number of unemployed workers getting benefits climbed to a new record, up to 6.35 million, setting a record for a 14th straight week. General Motors posted a $6 billion first quarterly loss today. It says it burned through more than $10 billion, more than it took in. And the automaker has received $15 billion in federal loans and faces a June the 1st deadline to finish restructuring plans or file for bankruptcy. And President Obama will provide details today on 121 cuts totaling $17 billion in his budget. He will also meet with leaders on education reform and host Russia's foreign minister in the Oval Office. That's a quick look at your news headlines for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway, and I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Let's follow the logic now. Yesterday on the Wall Street Journal front page, Bank of America and Citigroup are told they need billions of dollars. That's the unofficial leak from what are expected to be the official release of the stress test reports on the 19 largest banks. Well, Tim Geithner spoke yesterday on PBS's Charlie Rose Show.
They bear the responsibility for making sure they can convince their investors and their creditors that they can get through this with a strong, viable franchise. And I think they're going to be able to do that.
Geithner says it's up to the banks to convince investors to give them the billions they need to hold capital in reserve and make them look healthy. Eric Dash, New York Times banking reporter. It's a harder argument today if the banks fail the stress test to go out and get billions from investors, right?
Well, on one hand it is, but on the other it isn't. You know, the banks have already been given a lot of money last fall when they received this preferred investment stake, and that can be converted into common stock. So while many of the banks need money, it's not like that money is out of reach for them.
But is there a confidence factor here? Do the banks have to demonstrate confidence, and is somehow that harder to do with this kind of transparency, stress test, look at the bottom line approach that the Obama administration is taking?
Well, if you believe the administration officials, they'll tell you that it's going to be easier to do because they have a better handle on the losses of these institutions, and investors now will have a better handle on those losses as well. And so they'll be able to see that while the losses are going to be big, they're going to be manageable, and so investors' investment won't get wiped out, and that may encourage them to put more money into these banks.
What kind of economic scenario did the Treasury use to evaluate these banks in the stress test, and how pessimistic or optimistic is it?
So they used a variety of assumptions, like a 10.3% unemployment rate and I think a negative 3.3% GDP decline, which, you know, depending on who you ask, are either tough or not yet tough enough. But I think that sort of it's a little bit beside the point because a lot of these assumptions, one, feed into themselves, so they have the synergistic effect. And then two, the regulators were very harsh with the revenue assumptions that they used. And so while the on the loss side they may have been a little bit more lenient, on the revenue side they were tough, and so that impacted the capital levels as well.
Is it possible this is a lowering expectations game as well? I mean, in theory, a lot of these banks are getting almost free money from the Treasury and can charge interest rates, if you count credit cards, of up to like 18%. So the spreads on all kinds of investments are huge right now. That means bank profitability.
Well, I think what you're seeing is sort of the banks start healing themselves, and I think the administration hopes that if there's greater transparency, that they can aid in that process. Whether it works, though, is a different story.
And Eric Dash, do you think that somebody's going to get an A and somebody's going to get an F? Who would be on the top of the list of the stress tests and who would be on the bottom based on your reporting?
So I think that what we're going to see is no bank is going to fail as a result of these stress tests, and I think regulators have been very clear about that. But banks are in different conditions, and we're already starting to see a separation. I think a number of banks, you know, Wall Street and Washington are like American high schools. They're abuzz with rumors.
Right, there's above average and there's below average. And
exactly.
J.P. Morgan's probably above average, Citigroup below. Eric Dash, New York Times banking reporter, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I passed my stress test.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
She's a bad mother. Shut your mouth. Find out how moms get shafted in this environment, literally, when we come back after headlines from Femi Oke here in the studio.
Hello there. The time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. President Obama is expected to ask Congress today to cut $17 billion from the proposed 2010 budget. Pentagon spending takes about half of the hit, but those cuts pale next to another $1.3 trillion section of the budget the president has already asked Congress to pass. Staying on Capitol Hill, lawmakers from states that produce pork are worried about the focus on H1N1 or swine flu, and they're worried that it will make consumers afraid of eating pork. Both houses of Congress will hold hearings today on the outbreak, and legislators from pork-producing states will urge witnesses to reiterate that there is no connection between the flu and pork products. Fierce winds blew a raging wildfire into homes in Southern California yesterday. Thousands of people were forced to flee, and by sunset, around about 500 acres had burned. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has declared a state of emergency. Two former Bank of China managers and their wives have been sentenced to prison in the United States for a plan to embezzle hundreds of millions of dollars. A federal judge in Las Vegas found them guilty of a racketeering conspiracy that began in 1991. And finally, the world's oldest dog is celebrating her birthday. 21-year-old Chanel lives in Long Island, New York, and in dog
the
years...
The world's oldest dog? That's,
yes.
They don't know who the world's
she
oldest dog
is. The world's
no,
oldest
that's
dog.
That's ridiculous.
Because the previous owner died of a heart attack last year.
There's an older dog somewhere.
This is the oldest one, according to the Guinness Book of Records. She's actually 147, and her owner, Denise Shaughnessy, explains the secret of Chanel's longevity.
I just take good care of her. You know, I treat her just like I treat anybody, you know, any family member. I treat her like a person.
That's the secret. So Chanel is a Dachshund cross, and she's a little bit wobbly on her paws. She can't see or hear much, but other than that, she's doing very well considering her advanced age. John, 147 officially.
In dog years.
Yes, and she celebrated her birthday by going to the dog spa. That's a look at your news. Farai, you're looking at me like I'm a weird person.
Thanks so much, Femi. I say God bless. God bless. Anyway, I'm Farai, and it's Mother's Day on Sunday. We want to know, have you ever been tagged as a bad mom? We heard from Mimi in Mount Clemens, Michigan.
I guess I've got a bad mom rap right now because I'm having to work huge jobs 7 days a week, but their grandmothers are taking really good care of them. They're all like students, but I do get the bad mom rap, and I really don't appreciate that.
Who does? Call 877-8-MY-TAKE if you were annoyed with judgments about your parenting, or email mytake@thetakeaway.org. And here's my idea of a perfect mom giving some tough love.
Are you finished?
Well, Mom, you think of all the things I could have been doing. This is really nothing at all. We can just forget. Mom, the
makeup
was...
Vanessa, if you keep going, I think you should know that every single word you say from now on is only going to make me angrier. You get your little self up those stairs and don't come down here until I call you.
Yes, Mom.
That's right. Yes, Mom. Call me the Jedi. That's Claire Huxtable, played by Felicia Rashad from The Cosby Show, someone who can control children with her voice in that Jedi-like way. We also have with us, not just virtual, but here in the flesh, in the studio, Ayelet Waldman. Now, she's one mother who thinks of herself as far from perfect. She took a lot of heat after she wrote in the New York Times that she loved her husband more than her children. That was back in 05. Now, the author of multiple books and mother of multiple children, four to be exact, has a new memoir, Bad Mother, a chronicle of maternal crimes, minor calamities, and occasional moments of grace. Thanks for coming in the studio.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
You don't look like a bad mother to me.
Oh, it's all under the skin. Just ask my kids. They'll tell you the gruesome details.
What's the age range for your kids?
I have a 14-year-old, an 11-year-old, a 7-year-old, and a 6-year-old.
Wow. That's a lot of action.
Yeah, definitely.
It sounds, at the surface, you know, your book cover is great because it says good mother and then good is scratched out and written in sort of like this Sharpie is bad mother. And, you know, it sounds on the surface like it might be totally serious, but you're able to blend a distinct sense of humor along with what is a very touchy topic. Why'd you decide to tackle this full on?
Do you want the real answer? Or
yes.
Do you want the answer that I, you know, the nice, pleasant,
I don't want the book tour answer. I want the real answer.
Okay, the real answer is that I got so much grief a few years ago when I made that comment in the New York Times, which, in all honesty, was never even going to be in the New York Times. It was an essay I wrote for an anthology, which, you know books. Nobody reads anthologies. Sometimes people buy them as nobody ever reads them. So some friends of mine were putting together this anthology about motherhood, and they said, oh, Ayelet, we've got mothers talking about divorce and cancer and having twins, and we don't have anybody talking about sex. And, well, since you're the only one who knows who's having any, it's got to be you. So I
nice,
right? So I wrote this kind of – I started writing this kind of ha-ha little essay about, you know, how to maintain an intimate relationship with your husband when you have four children. But pretty soon I ended up in this pretty dark place writing about how the reason I was having sex and enjoying it wasn't because I was, you know, doing something right. It was because I had failed to do something. I was in fact, a bad mother because all these good mothers around me, well, they never had sex with their husband. And the reason they never did was because they had transferred all of their passion onto their children. So the piece gets picked up for the New York Times. I didn't really think through the difference between publishing a piece about my sex life in an anthology that nobody reads and publishing a piece about my sex life in, the paper of record. But it kind of went crazy. And, you know, I did end up on Oprah talking about it. And there were a lot of very angry women. And then over the course of as the emails came in and the articles and the appearances, I just started to get my back up a little bit, you know. And I thought, all right. You thought I was bad then? I'll give you bad.
All right. Give me an example of a moment that you felt judged. You have a lot of examples in this book, including one about breastfeeding and, you know, people just trying to, you know, your son had a cleft palate and people trying to tell you how to
breastfeed
him.
That was the best one. That was my favorite story. So my son had a bubble palate. If it had been any higher, it would have been cleft, but it actually closed over. But it meant it was impossible for him to nurse. And I did everything. I pumped for this child every 2 hours for 6 months, round the clock. So in the middle of this grim misery when I've got, you know, I'm pumping all the time, I'm going to lactate. I must have spent his college fund on lactation consultants. I'm standing in a cafe, and I'm holding him in the sling, because, you know, of course, I'm a good mother with a sling, and I'm feeding him the breast milk that I pumped at 4 o'clock in the morning, and I'm giving it to him, and the breast milk is tinged kind of purple from the gentian violet I've been using to combat the thrush I have from the pump. And this woman taps me on the shoulder, and she says, "You know, honey, breast is best." Now, if I was smart or wasn't on the verge of emotional collapse, I probably would have just kicked her in the shins and run out of the
cafe. You should have just broken her jaw, right?
Totally. Or at least used profanity. But instead, I immediately started crying and gave her the whole long saga of, you know, how I had tried to breastfeed him and he almost starved to death and now blah, 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 as if I owed this stranger, this judgmental stranger, anything resembling a confession.
You know, just to broaden this out a little bit, your experiences are ones that you speak of very specifically. And you're a tough cookie because, you know, you've been in the online writing world and people feel like they can comment on anything about you. But what do you want people to walk away with? Women certainly, you know, I expect will be the majority of your audience. But women or men who read this, what do you want them to walk away with?
Well, I think, you know, the world of female support, online, virtual, real, is an incredible thing. I don't think there's any mother who could get through her day or any, well, fathers are different, but I don't think there's any mother who can get through her day without having someone to give her the kind of support that she needs. But there's this really toxic side to that. So it my takeaway is really, really simple. Why don't we all just give ourselves a break? You know, I won't judge you. Or if I do judge you, I'll do it alone in my own house, and you won't even know about it. And if you would do me the same honor, we'd all be a lot happier.
All right. Well, that's Ayelet Waldman. You know, what can I say? You got it out there, and I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you guys so much.
Again, Ayelet Waldman, mother, lawyer, and author of Bad Mother, a chronicle of maternal crimes, minor calamities, and occasional moments of grace. She was right here in our studio. And to read the introduction of Bad Mother, go to our website, thetakeaway.org. And, you know, one listener thinks that we should not be talking about bad mothers at all. Says, Mother's Day is in a few more days from now. You should be playing stories of mothers who are role models, mothers who contribute to their community as well as their family. What is your take? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. And here's your takeaway.
At the end of the day, today's two-income family has less money left over after those five basic expenses than the one-income family had a generation ago.
There's a mom, Elizabeth Warren, chairwoman of the Congressional Oversight Panel, looking at the TARP. She's also the Gottlieb Professor of Law at Harvard University, or Harvard Law School, with your takeaway.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Huckenberry. Moms, take a break, won't you? This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Captain James T. Kirk, does he need an introduction?
Who are you?
Who do you think I am?
Don't tell me. You're from outer space.
No, I'm from Iowa. I only work in outer space.
A new Star Trek movie goes back in time to restart a franchise. As Kirk, Spock, McCoy, and Sulu age, technology marches on. We could be getting close to finding the dilithium crystals.
Are you out of your Vulcan mind? No human can tolerate the radiation that's in there.
As you are so fond of observing, Doctor, I am not human.
Is beaming up a scientific possibility? By the way, we're still human here at The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. I'm so out of my Vulcan mind. It's Thursday, May 7th. I'm John Hockenberry, joined this morning by Farai Chidea. Good morning, Farai.
Good morning, John. Coming up this hour, citizens in Delhi, India, step up to the polls. NASA takes a cue from Star Trek, and Elizabeth Edwards dishes to Oprah about her husband's affair.
Some dish.
Yep. Big one.
Huge helpings.
Those stories coming up, but first these headlines.
And in the headlines, new applications for jobless benefits are now at their lowest level in 14 weeks. The Labor Department said only 601,000 people applied for the benefits last week, but the total number of people getting the benefits climbed again. From the good to the bad, GM says it lost $6 billion last quarter and spent $10 billion more than it took in. How's your budget doing? GM has taken $15 billion in government loans to deal with hemorrhaging balance sheets, and it faces a June 1st government deadline to shape up or shift into official bankruptcy mode. It's report card day for the nation's 19 biggest banks. It's already leaked that the Treasury told some banks to find new cash sources fast. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner spoke to PBS's Charlie Rose last night.
It's up to the banks themselves to figure out how they can go raise this money, and it's in our interest that they're able to do it from private sources. So we're going to help reinforce that, backstop it, but the important thing is they go do it.
How would you like to have to raise $34 billion? There are reports that the Treasury told Citibank, Wells Fargo, and Bank of America to raise some capital. Fry?
In Pakistan, the Red Cross warns humanitarian crises there are getting worse. Ron Redman is the chief spokesman for the UNHCR, which has aid workers on the ground. He told The Takeaway this morning that refugees were crowding the roads in an attempt to flee the fighting in the Swat Valley. The actual number of those fleeing is unclear, but yesterday, the Pakistani president, Asif Ali Zardari, said his nation will overcome the Taliban.
Pakistan carries a huge burden confronting Al-Qaeda and Taliban together, but we are up to the challenge.
Clashes there began last week after the Pakistani army accused the Taliban of breaking a peace agreement. And today in Afghanistan, police fired into a crowd of protesters who were throwing rocks. They blame U.S. bombing runs in western Afghanistan for dozens of civilian deaths. But U.S. military officials says the Taliban is to blame for many of the deaths in that raid.
Investors like the job numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average begins trading at 85.12. Futures suggest a positive opening. The S&P starts trading at 9.20. After a big jump up yesterday. So, Star Trek movie opens for the weekend. It's huge. The IMAX screenings are already sold out. What sorts of technology do you think we should actually have in reality? 8778 My Take, where no listener has gone before.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
My democracy will deliver. People of Pakistan stand with the people of the United States and the people of Afghanistan.
That's Pakistan's President Asif Ali Zardari speaking yesterday at a meeting with Afghan President Hamid Karzai and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. The people of Pakistan stand with the people of the United States? Well, this morning there are a lot of people in Pakistan who aren't standing at all. They're running. Perhaps 500,000 people are potentially refugees because of battles taking place in the Swat Valley between Taliban militants and Pakistani military. Tens of thousands of people are already fleeing the region to escape the conflict. The fighting came hours ahead of those meetings between President Barack Obama and Pakistani President Asif Ali Zardari in Washington, to explore all kinds of ways to boost the country's anti-terror fight and actually to boost the credibility of Zardari himself. Joining us to talk about the issues in South Asia all this hour that are on the table in both Washington and places like Delhi and Islamabad is Sherry Rahman, former information minister and journalist. She resigned her post as an information minister for the Pakistani government of President Zardari on March 14th due to differences of opinion about imposing restrictions on the media. She joins us from Washington. Sherry Rahman, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And here in the studio, Mira Kamdar is a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute and an associate fellow of the Asia Society. She's also here to talk about this. Mira, thanks so much for coming in.
Glad to be here.
First of all, Sherry Rahman, what is necessary to improve the credibility of Ali Asif Zardari if the president is going to accomplish any of his goals, whether we're talking about terrorism or bolstering democracy in Pakistan?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to understand that the institutions of democracy in Pakistan have traditionally been fairly weak because of long periods of non-democratic rule, and we've really just had 1 year of an elected civilian government coming in. So it's important to strengthen all institutions and balance powers as per the constitution. So I think the most important thing right now is for democratic forces, including the presidency, to be strengthened and given as much support as possible, given the challenges on the scale and the magnitude of the challenges that any government in Pakistan would face right now. They need unity, resolve, and a fair amount of support.
Well, that sounds nice. And the President Zardari said yesterday that my democracy will deliver. But what realistically can President Zardari deliver?
Well, I think it's not just about President Zardari. It's a whole slew of institutions. There's a parliament which has a strong voice, and we do have a parliamentary system. The leader of the House is the prime minister. Right now, yes, there are extraordinary powers still vested in the presidency, but really the point is, even today, the parliament is considered the main public representative body because it comes through a direct election, and a great deal of national discourse as well as influence on executive decision making naturally emanates from there. So I think it's important to understand that all powers are not vested in the president.
Right. Well, Mira Kamdar, the Red Cross is now reporting that it's possible that 500,000 people are displaced in Pakistan or potentially refugees as a result of this fighting. When Barack Obama stands with Hamid Karzai and President Zardari of Pakistan and projects this sort of democratic front, is that credible to the people on the ground in Pakistan and Afghanistan?
Well,
oh, no, hold on. This is for Mira Kamdar, Sherry.
You know, I think it's probably not credible to a lot of those people. Unfortunately, a lot of those people view the United States as a potential, you know, source of a threat as the Taliban or Al Qaeda forces, and maybe even their own military. It doesn't really matter if you get bombed and you lose your family. You know, which of those is the source? And we just had a spectacular amount of civilian casualties in Afghanistan yesterday, mm-hmm. With a bombing that went awry. One of the issues that's been a problem for the Zardari government has been the drone attacks in Pakistan, which is, you know,
NATO drone attacks, the remote control planes. Yeah,
absolutely. And there's been a lot of civilian casualties. And I think, you know, really on the ground, in terms of the people of both those countries, they're very confused. They're really not sure who's the enemy, because they're right at this point, they're kind of getting it from all ways.
But perhaps they're not confused about one thing, and that is that Zardari has no control over Northwest Frontier Province. The latest Taliban fighting simply takes the fig leaf off. It's really clear to everyone in the world now.
Well, that's true. That's true. And the other thing they don't have any illusions of are what exactly the Taliban want to put into place in that valley. And I don't think that's what most of the people there want.
Sherry, do you have a comment?
Well, First of all, I'd quickly like to put in that, yes, the U.S. is seen as fairly predatory in terms of its footprint and, you know, constant invasions of Pakistan's sovereignty through those aerial strikes go down very badly across the a large swathe of public in support erosion in Pakistan for any government that is constantly seen in an American embrace. But having said that, I think we'd have to draw a fine line here between what is happening in terms of military action in Swat and Malakand and Bunair right now. Not so much in Swat, but in Bunair. This was, unfortunately, an action of last resort and very needed if there is a Taliban concentration and hijack of state writ. So it's very important for government, and particularly the frontier government, which is an elected government, to act. And again, I think we have to understand that we need some more nuance in this discourse, that it can't really be, it's not a presidential system, so it's not something that is entirely vested in the powers and decision-making of the president. Yes, he did sign those executive powers, but it is on the advice, as the Constitution says, and the insistence of the provincial government, which incidentally is also a secular party. This point has to be made. The people of those areas where the Taliban tried to take over, or rather was surrendered to them in many ways, elected progressive secular governments in majority, right. The ANP and then the PUP.
But it's the Taliban running the show right now. Go ahead, Farai.
Sherry, I wonder if you can just quickly give us a little context around your resignation. I mean, you have been a professional journalist for 20 years, then went in as Pakistan's federal minister for information, and then resigned. What was the straw that broke the camel's back?
Well, as I said earlier, that I had differences. We have very clear commitments on media freedoms. And while I think that our media is, we have over 100 channels running riot, yes, they do perhaps need a code of conduct, but it is something that that doesn't merit perhaps censorship or other kind of curbs that we've seen in earlier non-democratic regimes, so I did have differences on any such potential action.
Let me just, yes. Do you think that the president has manipulated his own image in the news then?
I don't think, well, the Pakistani media is quite free. In fact, it's very free, and we have certainly ensured that it is. We all have a bit of a hand in that. It's not something that can be rolled back. These freedoms were hard-earned. They will not ever, I don't see them really going back. So it's very difficult to manipulate anyone's image in the Pakistani media these days. It goes with what it wants to say.
And the image of President Zardari is pretty much at a low ebb in the Pakistani media at this point. Mira Kamdar, quickly before we end this segment, does Nawaz Sharif, the former prime minister, or the former president, have more credibility with the Taliban, who are making such gains on the ground in Northwest Frontier Province?
Is he more beloved of the Taliban than Zardari?
Who could talk with the Taliban and possibly end this?
I don't think so. I mean, there has been a little bit of a history there. I'm sure you're alluding to that. But I don't think so at this point. I mean, I really think at this point the Taliban is thumbing their nose at anything that represents the authority of the state.
Right.
They just blew up this police station, that was already had been vacated. But just to underline the fact that they are now the law, they are now the force in that area, and I don't think it matters whether it's Sharif or Zardari at this point, unfortunately.
And as we've seen in the past, chaos works for the Taliban. A final comment, Sherry?
Yes, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. They are indeed overtaking the monopoly, what should be the monopoly of the state, which is the use of force and executive authority, and it wouldn't matter who is in charge in Islamabad. To them, it's really it's a zero-sum game, and they're battling for territory, they're battling for control. They see state weakness as a sign, as a signal for potential takeover, and I think this is important to fight this.
Well, and it sounds like a secession on the ground there. Sherry Rahman, former information minister of the Zardari government in Pakistan, she resigned her post in March. Thank you, Sherry. And staying with us is Mira Kamdar, senior fellow at the World Policy Institute and author of Planet India, Turbulent Rise.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea. We are calling folks who wear their Star Trek uniform to work.
Oh, my God.
All right. We'd settle for anybody who wants to travel at warp speed or have a tricorder. Tell us what gadgets you'd like to see become reality.
Hey, this is Michael calling from NIAC. I wish we had teleportation. I commute 3 hours a day, and it would really help me out.
Are you out of your Vulcan mind?
3 hours a day. Hey, I'd like to teleport too. Now, if you want technology of the future, what would it be? 877-8-MY-TAKE or email mytake@thetakeaway.org. And you know that the first interracial kiss ever was on Star Trek.
Good trivia.
Yes, between Kirk and Uhura, but they didn't really want to do it. They were forced to do it by an alien force that took over their mind because, God forbid, a black woman should kiss a white man. You know what I'm saying? Anyway, we now want to just dig even deeper.
We are traveling at warp speed. How did you manage to beam aboard this ship?
Hey, you're the genius. You figure it out.
As acting captain of this vessel, I order you to answer the question.
Well, I'm not telling, acting captain.
Ooh, snap! That is from the new Star Trek movie being released nationwide today. By the way, if you live in New York, the IMAX screening sold out weeks ago, and they're being scalped on Craigslist for up to $80. But anyway, folks are excited to see this film. Could there be, question, real versions of some of the technology that exists in Star Trek? Believe it or not, NASA's trying to figure that out. With us, we've got Mark Millis, the former head of NASA's Breakthrough Propulsion Physics Project. It's explored the possibilities of traveling at a speed faster than light. Now, Mark, we want to talk to you about your project, but first, let's get a little overview of where pop cult meets reality. What in Star Trek actually exists, and also what was NASA trying to develop that exists in Star Trek?
Well, first I'm going to talk about, here's the obvious one. I got a real cell phone before I even was able to obtain this toy. The viewers who are as old as me will recognize what that sound is.
Phaser.
No, it's a communicator.
No, that was
a communicator.
Yes. And, you know, I remember the sliding doors and how many grocery stores had those. But when it comes to the spacecraft itself and its engines, all that is in the realm of fiction today. Aside from the emerging science part, which I can get into shortly. Here's another big one that's usually taken for granted that Star Trek has that is really not able to be done yet, is they have gravity on board, synthetic gravity on board, and that's usually taken for granted. That would be a big deal.
I think it's because they filmed the program on planet Earth where there is gravity.
Yeah, normal studio conditions.
Yeah,
yes.
I think that's right. So what about a tricorder? Is that possible? You know, the thing that can do anything, heals anything, can find anyone and tell it if you're healthy?
Well, there's definitely parts of that have advanced, you know, being able to scan things and sense various things. But as far as a handheld device that can also help fill in those plot gaps when you need some quick way to advance a story, no, we don't have those.
Yes. You know, one thing that I'm curious about, and this may be switching a horse in midstream a little too fast, is just how pragmatic is it to spend tax dollars on this? I mean, you know, it fascinates me, but really, how does this get justified as a line item in a budget?
Okay. Well, two things. One, NASA's not supporting it anymore. So actually here today, I'm representing myself rather than NASA.
Yes. Yeah.
Your previous experience. But when NASA was funding it, there's only so far that you can push the technology before it's bucking up against its physics limits. I mean, the science of even how it operates. And to consider moving beyond that, you have to look at emerging science. And there were enough clues in the peer-reviewed scientific literature saying that, you know, there's possibilities here that we could look at. And at a low level of funding, you know, look at it. And I guess to put in perspective, too, not including my salary, which is book kept in a different thing, but the actual funding for all the research at NASA did on this under my project was about $1.5 million.
So that's pretty small.
That's very modest.
Yeah. But scientifically, how would beaming work or a warp drive actually work?
Okay, well, on the I'm going to skip the beaming part because that one's even deeper into the fiction. But warp drive itself, the trick behind that, and actually 1994 was the first time it came out in a peer-reviewed journal, and the author did use the title warp drive. But even though there's a speed limit for how fast something can move through space-time, what you can do with space-time itself is still up for debate. And the idea here is that you move a chunk of space-time faster than light and carry inside it the vehicle, and to the people on board the vehicle, they don't even know they're moving. This is done by expanding space-time behind it and compressing space-time in front of it. And so that's the theory behind that. And this is at the level of theory, mathematical equations, which gets to some of the bad news. The amount of energy it would require to do that is enormous.
More than a few Prius batteries?
Yes.
I'm sort of seeing that more moment when they go to warp speed where there's just that great visual contrail of, like, color. But I'm guessing that you're saying because of the enormous energy that we're not going to see that anytime soon.
Well, not anytime soon, but what we might get to is now with some high-powered lasers, we might actually get into the point in a few years where the intensity of the magnetic and electric fields that can be created by those lasers in a very small spot might allow you to test if some of these space warping theories are indeed correct, even though that's, you know, just a laboratory kind of test the waters kind of thing.
You know, one of the things that comes to mind is the idea of a manned Mars mission, which has been explored and is not totally dead from what I understand, at least, you know, with various international parties. I'm assuming that if we did have warp speed, then how fast would it take to get to Mars?
Oh, it depends upon where Mars is, but I would guess roughly about 20 minutes.
It's a lot better than years, which is how long it would take conventionally with our technology. Love it. I'm going to go to Mars for lunch. We were talking with Mark Millis, former head of NASA's Breakthrough Propulsion Physics Project. He's also the editor and co-author of Frontiers of Propulsion Science. And now we have Femi Okeh with the news.
Thank you very much. 29 minutes past the hour. The Red Cross says the crisis is worsening in Pakistan. It says that aid workers are unable to reach the areas most affected by the fighting between Taliban militants and the Pakistani army. It estimates that up to 500,000 people have been displaced. Yesterday in Washington, Pakistani President Asif Ali Zardari and Afghan President Hamid Karzai and President Obama pledged joint cooperation to fight militants threatening the region in northwest Pakistan. Mexicans are going back to work today after a five-day shutdown of businesses, and that's due to the H1N1 virus or swine flu. Public places like sports arenas, movie theatres and restaurants are all open again, but businesses must screen people who look sick and employees and customers have to wear masks. That's a quick look at your news headlines for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea. Hey, we would use a lot less gasoline if we could only teleport.
I don't know about that, though. Huge amounts of energy. Huge, he was saying.
How about volcanic energy from the center of the Earth?
There you go. Now you're talking geothermal transporting.
We are talking about Trek-like technology in advance of this big movie opening. That's so brilliant. What would you like to see? You want to teleport? How about going at warp speed? What do you want? My take at thetakeaway.org or 877-8-MY-TAKE, John.
She can actually deliver that? Wow, that's incredible. We should have her on more. So a Democratic front at the White House in South Asia. That was the photo op. Hamid Karzai, Barack Obama, and Asif Ali Zardari, the president of Pakistan, projecting that Democratic front in meetings yesterday. But perhaps the most profound pictures of democracy in South Asia come from India, where polling stations are open today. It's India's marathon five-phase election. Phase four begins today. Delhi is one of the key battlegrounds. Millions of voters casting their ballots there today. Coming back to The Takeaway is Meera Kamdar, senior fellow at the World Policy Institute, associate fellow of the Asia Society, and author of Planet India, The Turbulent Rise of the Largest Democracy and the Future of Our World. So the future of our world is really, in a sense, at stake, at least one-sixth of the world in those polling stations in India. Is that right, Meera?
Well, yes, it is, and it's a white heat. Absolutely no one knows what the outcome of this election is going to be.
And that's because neither of the main parties are going to get a parliamentary majority, and there are hundreds of smaller parties in the election. So the formation of a coalition is really about as elaborate as, some fabrics you could probably buy in the bazaars there in Delhi.
Yeah, I mean, it's a complex, dynamic, multicultural country, and the political system has more and more come to resemble that. Every election is more complicated than the one before, and this one is no exception. It really is going to be difficult for one of the major parties, the BJP or the Congress, to cobble together enough support to hit that magic 272-seat number to take power.
Now, the credibility, the traditional historical credibility of the Congress party is really off the table. The kind of religious issues that really were behind the BJP's rise are not really as relevant this time around. Is it the economy, stupid?
It is totally the economy, stupid. I mean, it's interesting, given all that's going on in the region. We just, had the segment on what's going on right next door to India. This is really not an issue in this election. It's bread and butter issues. Let's not forget that it's the poor in India that vote. So the poorer you are, the more likely you are to vote. And for the poor in India, 46% still living, according to the World Bank, on less than $1.25 a day. It's about food. It's about jobs. It's about housing. It's about education for their children.
So what is the credibility of successful business people in India? In the United States, of course, you can say credibly that I've been successful in business and you get elected to Congress or even the Senate. Is that not the case in India?
That's absolutely not the case in India. You have to sort of make the case that you're a friend of the common man, what's known as Aam Aadmi. That is the theme that all that sort of line that all the parties try to toe when it comes to election time.
This is a much more general question, but I remember my mother years ago working with a number of people from India, and the common language they had was English, because there are so many languages, so many religions, so many regions. The whole idea of doing this kind of election in batches fascinates me. What are the upsides and downsides of that?
Well, it's really just a pragmatic necessity. You have more than 700 million eligible voters. More than 400 million are expected to vote across the country. And just simply to coordinate that in a situation where in many regions half the people are illiterate, for example, it just wouldn't be possible to pull it off on one day.
But I love the fact that the population of people actually voting in this five-phased election exceeds the entire population of the United States, with about 200 million to spare.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive.
It is really, really amazing.
In South Africa, there were, actions and ballots to make sure that there were photographs to deal with the issue of illiteracy. What's being done with the balloting to help people who can't read?
Well, every party has a symbol. And so people know to identify, that symbol with X symbol with X party. And then the system of voting in order to make sure that people don't vote twice, or that, it's just one person, one vote, an indelible ink mark is put on the finger so that, everybody is clear as to who voted.
We saw that a lot in Afghanistan.
Right. Barack Obama, in speaking with Pakistan's leader yesterday, says that the U.S. has an interest in a democratic, healthy, secure Pakistan. That's a difficult argument to make in Pakistan, but there is a secure, democratic set of institutions in India. What is the U.S. interest in the outcome of this election as you see it, Meera?
Well, first of all, we have a huge interest in just the fact that India is there as an example in the region of a country that is able to change its government peacefully by the will of the people. It's kind of a rarity in South Asia. So there's that. In terms of the actual outcome, if it's one of the two major parties at the head of a coalition, the policy toward the United States is not really going to change that much. The left, the sort of third way, which I think is a real long shot, though they may be in a position to form one of the two coalitions led by either the BJP or the Congress, they have pledged to do away with the nuclear deal, do away with the U.S.-India agricultural agreement.
The nuclear deal is the nuclear technology cooperation agreement that was signed at the end of last year, I believe.
In December of last year. Yeah. It's considered the one foreign policy success of the Bush administration, in a sort of landscape. landscape of debacle. And so the left in India, which quit the Congress Party over that issue and almost brought the government down, has pledged to do away with that. But I think it's a long shot they'll come to power.
So on the 16th of May, we should know one way or another. That's when the outcome in the Indian elections will be clear. We'll be back to talk all about it. Meera Kamdar, thanks so much for being with us. She's a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute and associate fellow of the Asia Society. She wrote Planet India, The Turbulent Rise of the Largest Democracy and the Future of Our World. Thanks so much. And now Femi Okay has our headlines.
At 22 minutes to the top of the hour, General Motors lost $6 billion in the first quarter. That loss cut the automaker's revenue nearly in half. GM says the company's possible bankruptcy appeared to have scared off buyers. GM faces a June the 1st government deadline to finish a restructuring plan, or they will face Chapter 11. The government announced that it will back GM and Chrysler warranties, but not until much later in the quarter. New claims for jobless benefits dropped to its lowest level in 14 weeks. The Labour Department says that 601,000 people applied for the benefit, but the overall number of those still getting benefits has climbed to a new record. Around about 6.35 million people are still getting help. Santa Barbara County in California is under a state of emergency. Fires are still blazing out of control, and they have forced thousands to evacuate. Commander Darren Fotheringham is a spokesperson for the Santa Barbara County Sheriff's Department, and he warns that people who have been evacuated have to stay away.
We're asking that anyone who has been already evacuated remain out of the area, and for anyone else that feels a desire to go up there and look around, to please stay out of the area and enable the fire department to do their job.
Officials from Santa Barbara say the fire warning will remain in effect until tomorrow. And in international news, the Defense Secretary Robert Gates has told Marines in Afghanistan there aren't any plans to deploy U.S. troops to Pakistan, and that's in spite of the growing violence there. That's a look at stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea. Now, this is high tech, but not about pop cult and Star Trek. Criminal justice systems in a number of countries are expanding advanced DNA databases to keep track of criminals, also people accused of crimes. But Britain announced today that it plans to scale back its national DNA database. That follows a ruling by the European Court of Human Rights last year criticizing Britain's practice of keeping on file the DNA of anyone who'd been arrested, even if they were not charged with a crime. The BBC's political correspondent Naomi Grimley is with us. So, Naomi, what is the government now proposing?
Well, as you mentioned, the European Union said that it was too indiscriminate, was the word they used, the idea that you could keep someone's data on record for the rest of their lives, even if they've been cleared of any offence. So now the government is suggesting that they still want to hold on to the data of innocent people, but they're going to make it a finite period. So, for example, if you've been arrested but not convicted of a serious violent or sexual offence, they'll still want to keep your data for 12 years. And if you've been arrested but not convicted of any other kind of crime, they still want to hang on to that data for 6 years. So the government says it's better than the old system. But on the other hand, a lot of civil liberties groups say it's still too long to hang on to this kind of personal data.
I'm going to return to the situation in the UK in a moment, but let me just make a comparison. Here in the US, we've been wrestling with this question as well. Last month, the FBI started collecting DNA samples from people who were awaiting trial. So, you know, our train has left the station perhaps a little bit later than yours. And 15 states have already started doing that, collecting DNA samples from people awaiting trial. We're kind of perhaps going the other direction. What kinds of concerns overall does this raise with civil liberties advocates?
Well, they're concerned along a series of lines. I mean, for example, if you go to the American system, as you've suggested, the FBI, I gather, are also taking DNA from detained immigrants. Now, that kind of thing would cause a lot of problems, I think, if it was suggested in Britain. Civil liberties groups say it's just blurring the line between the guilty and the innocent. They're also worried about other things, like, for example, whether criminals are getting more canny at planting DNA at crime scenes. So they're worried that in some cases, the government may be too reliant on DNA evidence for convictions. That said, government ministers are still sticking by these databases. I mean, they say a lot of criminal convictions are brought about because of DNA evidence. And they go further and they say, well, actually, in some cases, people are actually exonerated because of DNA evidence. So you can see it's one of those arguments where both sides of the debate have very fiercely held views.
Last question. It seems here that the UK was responsive to a larger European call on this issue. Is this something where Europe is trying to standardize itself on the DNA issue?
Well, they certainly have a very diverse system if you look at different countries. Perhaps if you look at Italy or Sweden, for example, samples have to be destroyed when someone's acquitted or cleared. In France, on the other hand, they do retain the material for 25 years, though in that case, a judge can actually order it to be expunged if an individual wants it to be. So a very disparate system. And I think, like you say, the European Union will want to have a more standardized procedure.
All right, Naomi Grimley, BBC political correspondent. Thanks.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
And now we've got Femi Oke with the headlines.
Thank you very much. The time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. President Obama meets with Russia's foreign minister in the Oval Office today, and they are likely to talk about the nuclear arms reduction treaty. Yesterday, Russia expelled two NATO officials from Moscow after NATO revoked the credentials of two Russian envoys at the alliance's headquarters. And earlier this week, Russia condemned NATO military drills in Georgia, calling them a provocation. So there will be lots for the president and Russia's foreign minister to discuss today. The president's nominees for the Food and Drug Administration, Margaret Hamburg, will face questions over food safety on Capitol Hill today. It's part of her Senate confirmation hearing. The agency has come under fire for a salmonella outbreak in peanuts earlier this year. The mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, died this morning, just 2 days after losing a re-election bid. Mayor Frank Melton was supposed to go back to court next week on federal civil rights charges. Melton was to stand trial on charges relating to a 2006 raid on a house that he considered a crack haven. He was 60 years old. In international news, the Chinese government is releasing its first official tally of student deaths from the massive earthquake that devastated the Sichuan province a year ago. China says more than 5,300 students died or have gone missing because of that disaster. The overall death toll is almost 69,000. And another 18,000 are still missing. They were never found. And the Red Cross warns that the humanitarian crisis in Pakistan is getting worse. Ron Redmond is the chief spokesperson for the UNHCR, which has aid workers on the ground. His team say the streets are so crowded with people who are trying to flee that a journey that normally takes 2 hours is now taking four.
So it's a huge number of people coming out, and they're joining a very, very large number of people who were already displaced in that region last year, some 555,000.
Clashes began in northwest Pakistan this week after the Pakistani army accused the Taliban of breaking a peace agreement. Let's look at big stories making headlines this morning. John
Thank Fry. You, Femi.
Yes, thank you very much. And, you know, in further media news, Oprah Winfrey's show is going to get a spike today, not like Oprah's hurting. But today she's got Elizabeth Edwards, a woman who's made headlines for fighting cancer, facing the loss of her child, standing by her man, standing by her man with some caveats. Her husband, of course, is former senator and presidential candidate John Edwards. And last August, he admitted to having an affair with filmmaker Riel Hunter. Elizabeth Edwards has a new memoir, Resilience, that's coming out next week. And we're here to discuss her and the trials of political power couples. Gail Sheehy is in studio with us. She's a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and has written books, including Hillary's Choice, which in the year 2000 examined another woman in the crosshair of power and relationships. Gail, now you're someone who's really done a lot of landmark writing about power and people. Oprah's getting a lot of buzz for this interview. Here is Elizabeth Edwards talking to Oprah Winfrey.
What John had said is this woman had spotted him in the hotel in which he was staying. He was meeting with someone in the restaurant bar area, and she had verified with someone who John worked with that it was John. And then John had gone to dinner. I didn't speak to her then, but he'd gone to dinner at a nearby restaurant, and then he had walked back to the hotel. And when he walked back, she was standing in front of the hotel and said to him, you are so hot, I can't deliver it, because I don't know how you deliver such a line as that.
Wow, that's a moment where you have the scorned wife telling the story about how her husband was picked up. And she says, basically, I don't even know how to deliver a pickup line. Is it her innocence, Gail, that makes her a sympathetic figure? Is she someone who, how would you describe her public persona?
Well, I think it's changed now. We've always thought of her as a great, courageous and resilient woman. Now she's out publicly flogging her husband in a book that should be called Revenge. And she tells the story. I think we have to ask why, when she was told her husband was having an affair shortly after he announced for president, she told him not to run. But he went ahead and did it, and she went out and told us that he went along with the charade, telling us that he was a good man with family values, he had the character to be president, something that she has not held up to.
So, you know, a lot of people questioned that decision, but then there were sort of, you know, leaks, if you can call it that, from, you know, friends and family members who basically said, look, if she wasn't sick, if she didn't have the prospect that her children would have no parent when she eventually dies from what is considered incurable breast cancer, she wouldn't stay with this guy. You know, how much is that narrative playing into this?
Well, you know, I think when Elizabeth Edwards was given the worst possible news that she had a recurrence of incurable cancer 3 months after her husband announced his presidential candidate, why did she choose to be part of a public charade? Why did she pass off a malpractice husband as a righteous family man? And why weren't we, as the media, writing outraged op-ed saying, why doesn't he drop out and be the caregiver for his wife in a time of trauma for his family?
All right. Well, there's a couple other famous moments in politics, relationships, and betrayal.
I have acted in a way that violates my obligations to my family and that violates my or any sense of right and wrong.
And
I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again. I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky.
All right. Elliot
Those
Spitzer.
Are pretty famous, yeah.
Elliot Spitzer, who is right now on CNBC as we are talking about this. He seems to have been sort of crawling back into a rehabilitated state. And President Bill Clinton, both of them cheaters. And your 2000 book, Hillary's Choice, tackled some of these issues, Gail. How do women in sort of the you know, passenger or co-pilot seat in these power relationships react to them?
Well, I think political wives at the highest level have a great investment in the success of their husbands. They've been with them all the way along. They put their own political aspirations aside, hoping that they will eventually be served either by their husband or themselves.
And they're used to dealing with these headstrong guys who are going to do it their own way anyway. Right.
Right? And they have an unlimited capacity for denial. You see it in Elizabeth Edwards' current book saying, you know, she hoped that it was only one night, but she obviously suspected otherwise. You know, one notable exception was Newt Gingrich's second wife. It's an interesting case.
You covered that story, right?
Yes, I did. And, you know, Newt Gingrich was a very insecure man. He told me, I found a way to immerse my insecurities in a cause large enough to justify whatever I wanted to do. And that's one of the hallmarks of these kinds of political.
So the public life excuses the private infidelity.
That's right. And even Gary Hart told a Publishers Association, the scrutiny stops when it gets to private life. It has no impact on your public, on your ability to hold office. Anyway, Newt Gingrich, behaved as other people's rules didn't apply to him. He's running around with other women through both of his marriage, and crusading as Speaker of the House is a moral crusader. Well, his second wife, when she gave me an interview as he was preparing to run for president, said, "I don't want Newt to be president, and I don't think he should be."
Hmm.
Wow. So she told him, "If I don't agree, it's easy. I just go on the air the next day, and I undermine everything." But she didn't have to, because Gingrich was caught having an affair with a staffer.
It came out.
Yeah, I want to just have one more little visit with Elizabeth Edwards via Oprah.
You asked your husband for just one gift when you got married. What was that?
I wanted him to be faithful to me. It was enormously important to me.
You said no rings, no flowers.
Yeah, I'm not much of a jewelry person.
Mm-hmm.
I actually jammed my finger, so I can't even wear my wedding ring right now.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't care about those kinds of things.
All right, Gail, you have not cut her a lot of slack on this. Final word, is this someone who will be seen by the public as sympathetic or seeking revenge, as you argued?
Well, I think both. But, there's a humorous side to this issue. I've often wondered, John, why Democrats are outed for affairs more often than Republican presidents or presidential candidates. And, maybe it's because Republicans sleep with their own kind and Democrats sleep beneath themselves. And those women sell their stories to the tabloids.
On that note, Gail Sheehy, thank you so much. Gail Sheehy is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and the author of many books, including Hillary's Choice. And I know what I'm doing this weekend.
I like this ship.
It's exciting.
Space is disease and danger.
Threat
and
darkness.
All right, Saturday night, me and the Geek Squad are going to see Star Trek the movie. We've been speaking earlier with Mark Millis, former head of NASA's Breakthrough Propulsion Physics Project. He's also the editor and co-author of Frontiers of Propulsion Science, and here's what he thinks of the Starship Enterprise.
They have gravity on board, synthetic gravity on board, and that's usually taken for granted. That would be a big deal.
All right. Would you let your kids go on a manned mission to Mars if they could go at warp speed and be back in time for dinner?
Well, sure, as long as they weren't driving. Why not? I'm a good dad.
I'm Farai Chidea.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Are you out of your fucking mind?
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.